Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry. I'm your host, Andrew Jelina. With me this week is Jeff Krampf, who leads a software development group at Bose. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Andrew.
Thank you for joining us on this cold winter's day.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Tell us a bit about what was the gateway thing? What got you interested in computing? I think you had access to an Apple II Plus back in high school.
Way back when, yes, my stepfather was taking courses on educational technology, and he had an Apple II Plus kicking around, and I decided to start playing around with it. And that got me hooked. There was a great community in those days, and just went off and learned how to do things.
You start off with basic programming?
Basic programming, yeah, and a little bit of machine language as well.
Ah, did you manage to get the entire thing to lock up a few times while doing assembler?
In those days, you would do peeks and pokes, and I had no idea what I was poking at. So yes, sometimes yep. I did.
Then I think you went to RPI for CS, right?
I did, yes.
What was your favorite course there or favorite professor?
Oh, that's a really good question. I took a mix of both the software courses and the hardware courses. I really liked the computer architecture courses, as well as networking and programming language constructs.
Very nice. And then I think you did a minor in electrical engineering too, right?
I did, yes. I've always been one to kind of want to know how things work A to Z. So yep. Going all the way down to the circuits was a fun thing for me to do.
And then I think after school, your first job was at Raytheon?
It was, yeah. We were building high-performance graphics systems. The main project was for air traffic control, but we had some spinoffs to build color workstations for the Navy to use in different programs.
I think you guys were working with some stuff you licensed from Silicon Graphics, the old SGI.
The old SGI, yes. It was state-of-the-art in those days. They pioneered a lot of areas such as graphics pipeline and graphics-oriented kernels and libraries. And at Raytheon, we took those and we extended them and genericized them for these workstations that we were building.
Are they like X-Terms and X-Windows type stuff?
Yep. They were Unix-based workstations with X-Windows running on them. And we had multiple displays and concurrent window managers and all kinds of fun things.
I'll never forget the first time I VPN'd in to work in the late 90s and then set the display to like my local IP and shot an X-term back there and it showed up on my desktop. I was like, wow, that's pretty cool.
It was like the coolest thing, wasn't it?
Yeah. Now we all take it for granted. Although, you know, I was complaining to the guys in the office the other day. So I use Microsoft RDP since like the late 90s. We were at Monster. We'd RDP all over the place to administer servers and whatever, or to work from home on occasion. I swear RDP is slower now, even though we have 100 times faster internet and 100 times faster machines.
There's always more things to do.
Yep.
Right.
Was that the visual technology you were working with, like C code compiled in with some assembler in order to build those systems?
That was a lot of C code, yeah. And you're right, there was assembler at the core and there was microcode as well. Although on the microcode side, I was more of an observer and understanding what was going on.
And then did you have to do any performance profiling while you were doing that?
Absolutely, yeah. So these were very high performance systems and every cycle counted.
Did you have any off-the-shelf tools you used or are you kind of rolling your own stuff to figure out wall clock time or CPU time?
There were some tools that we had, especially from the X Windows suite and the GNU compilers and profilers, but there was a lot of manual work too in kind of seeing what was going on under the hood and optimizing for that.
And so in your next job, you continued working on graphics and performance with visual technology?
I did, yeah. Visual was a pioneer in X terminals, so distributed graphics systems. And I followed through with a lot of that knowledge from Raytheon into building these high performance systems at Visual.
So is that like a render farm? Or what were they doing with the high performance graphics?
They were for desktop use. So essentially, you could view it as a diskless workstation in those days.
And you're doing primarily C code there, compiling it into assembly in order to make it perform?
That's right. So it was C code. So we were on a resource-limited real-time system, the node disk, and every cycle counted. So we would compile and we would look at the assembly code, the machine code, the opcodes for the processors and go down and understand exactly what was going on. So a lot of graphics comes down to very tight loops, doing the same operation over and over again, and every single cycle counts. So it was fascinating just to see the layout of the opcodes and how the pipelines and the processors were being used, and then to go, okay, well, if I change the order of this, or maybe I change the order of an if statement, I get back a few cycles in an inner loop, and bam, I've got a big boost in performance.
Multiplied by a million, it adds up.
That's right.
So I spoke to some guys way back when who were doing Mac development with a bunch of graphics stuff. And I think they were saying it was faster to write to an off-screen buffer and then slam that buffer onto the screen. Is that the same sort of thing you guys were doing?
We did some of that same thing too. That was called the bitblit operation. But in some cases, yes, it was faster to do things and then to copy them, especially if you had to copy them many times onto the screen buffer because there was a performance hit into writing into the screen buffer.
Yeah, these guys were pretty far ahead of their time. It was like a little startup that came out of UMass called Specular. They made a product called Infinity that was for like 3D animation, and it had everything in it, lights and textures and surfaces. It ended up getting bought and used in a bunch of broadcast stuff. But I remember they showed me, they were prototyping while I was at UMass. They had a distributed render farm that would take each frame from each scene and send it out to like 20 computers that each had their own GPU, and they would all crunch a little piece of it and send it back, and you'd see that fill in on the screen. That was pretty neat stuff.
Distributed systems, parallel processing.
Yeah, way back in the day.
Yeah.
And so visual technology merges with White Pine software. What happens then?
So the idea at the time was this X terminal market or X Windows connectivity was becoming ubiquitous. And we brought together standalone solutions for the desktop, as well as X servers for PCs and Macs. So we kind of hit critical mass in that space.
So sometimes the Vikings would, upon arriving at a shore they were invading, they would actually set foot on shore and burn the longboats as kind of a, all right, we're here, we have to be committed, there's no way back. Has anything like that ever happened to you in a professional capacity?
That's funny you should mention it. I learned in Raytheon that you should always understand what you're being sent into and especially know how you're going to get home from there. So I was just a kid out of college and working at Raytheon, and they came along and they said, would you like to go to beautiful Washington, D.C. and help out a customer there? I said, sure, of course. Yeah, that sounds great. So I got down to Washington, D.C., and Raytheon was working with another defense partner. And there were kind of some problems with the relationship. Some things were running late. And I got down there, and they presented me this whole range of problems and then said, we're going to keep you here until you figure them out. And I said, well, that's a little bit more than I signed up for. And then I remembered when Raytheon offered to send me down to the customer, they told me at the time that they only had a one-way ticket to send me, but go ahead down there and we'll get you the return ticket. So it turns out that no one was really willing to give me a return ticket. And I'm looking at this saying, you know, I came down for a few days and I could be here for months. And so we're working through the issues and, you know, the partner saying, no, we won't let him go. And Raytheon saying, you should let him go. No, we won't let him go. And finally, it took, I don't know what it was, a high-ranking official in the Navy that finally looked at everybody and said, let the poor kid go home. He's fixed what he can. He'll go back. They'll figure it out on that end. So lesson learned. Don't get into a situation until you understand it and have a way to get home.
And if your company's only buying you a one-way ticket, know that you're, you're headed for a whirl of hurt.
Should have seen that coming.
Then the all-nighter is kind of a badge of honor amongst folks who are in the technology industry. I think you have a all-nighter story from visual technology.
I do. So believe it or not, I got through college without doing any all-nighters.
Wow.
But it was at Visual where I saw the sunrise so many times from my desk. And I credit my CTO and boss at the time in teaching me the importance of pulling through to the goal. And we worked many a night, but there was one night where another lesson learned was if you have a big demo coming up and it's working, leave it. We got it to a point where it was working around 6 o'clock. We had a demo the next morning at 9 a.m. And we decided to tweak things just a little bit more, and we broke them. And we couldn't recover because we hadn't saved our previous work. So we worked through the whole night to recover what we did. And lo and behold, somewhere around 8, maybe even 8:30, we got things working again, and we were ready for the 9 o'clock demo. And I was just about ready to put my head down on the desk when somebody tapped on the door and said, "Is that your car in the parking lot?" And I said, "Yeah, as a matter of fact, it is." And they said, "Well, you better get out there very quickly because they're towing all the cars in advance of this event." And I'm like, "You can't do this to me. I worked the whole night and you're going to tow my car too." So I went running out and saved the car. And then we had a good demo.
I hope you did after that.
Yeah, after that, it was all smooth.
Well, you got all the ironing out of the way, as it were. Yeah, that's been a lesson learned for me too. Once you get the demo working, slap down a label, pull a branch, do whatever you have to do to snapshot it. I've even seen people go so far as to say, "You know what? We're just going to take screenshots of stuff and show that because I know PowerPoint won't break." But once you got it working, if you can avoid touching it, avoid touching it.
And the most important thing is go home so you can't get yourself into trouble.
Absolutely. And then I think from Cornell, you guys got involved with See You, See Me, which I remember from back in the day and being blown away. And, you know, now we're probably working with its great-great-grandson.
That's right. It was a really awesome technology and project to be working on. So the thinking was that we were already doing distributed graphics, distributed connectivity between all types of systems. What was the next big thing coming? And Cornell University had developed CUCME with funds from the NSF, the folks who helped build a lot of the core internet technologies out there. And that technology came up for license. So White Pine decided to bid on it, and we got the license. And then we had that big challenge of building it out. Lots of people had piloted the technology around the world and could not wait to get a high-performance enterprise version of it or consumer version of it with high-powered features.
So how would you describe it to the layman? Would it be kind of like a Skype video call with a lower frame rate? Or how would you describe it to folks that had never seen it these days?
That's right. It's like a Zoom or a Skype 20, 25 years ago. So when we first started, you would literally see black and white images with little boxes filling in, and it could take you 20, 30 seconds to see one frame. But it was exciting because you could have 30 of those frames in a conference from all over the world. In our first version, we added color. We added a much higher performance codecs, video technology. We added audio. The Windows product did not have audio. We added screen sharing and whiteboarding and really came out with this powerful product. We directed it towards the enterprise, where these features were very relevant, but towards the consumer world as well. And we had folks all around the world connecting using our technology.
So there was a freeware version and then a enterprise version that you could license if you were a big company that wanted to do some super advanced video conferencing at the time?
Yeah, we had all stages. So we had a freeware version out there. We had a point-to-point and multi-point consumer version, the shrinkware that you would buy right off the shelf. We had a conferencing service for conferences on demand. We had enterprise bundles with clients, servers, and middleware.
God, what year is this?
This is the late 90s.
Wow.
So we were a little bit ahead of our time for the home use. The wires were still a bit slow then. We had to support everything from the highest performance enterprise systems that had our software and also had these really expensive systems from Polycom installed on the one end. And on the other end, we still had to be able to connect in 28.8 modems.
Oh, I remember fooling around with it over dial-up and saying, "You know what, I got to go to school where the T1 is in order to really try this out."
You had to be really patient to use it over 28.8.
Yeah. How were you compressing the audio and the video? Like, do you remember what sort of codecs or algorithms you guys were using back then?
Yeah, on the audio side, a lot of the algorithms are still in use depending on the application, but PCM, CIA, DeltaMod. On the video side, we started with some proprietary codecs. We moved on to Motion JPEG and eventually H.263 and 264, which became conferencing standards.
Yeah. Just now, H.265 starting to catch on. Not every machine handles it. H.264 has been the standard for the better part of 20 years.
Yeah, it's a good standard. Things do move forward, but it's good to see it stick.
So what were some of the cool but unexpected things you saw people doing with CUCME?
That's a really good question. You give people a camera and you don't know what happens, right? So there were a lot of great stories. We had CUCME Santa visits to kids in hospitals. We had CUCME weddings. We had many, many stories of folks meeting over CUCME. That was one end of the spectrum. On the other end of the spectrum, we had deployments around the world. The DoD, for example, was a big customer of ours. So people connecting with each other all over the place. And it's funny, even years later, when I mentioned CUCME, a lot of people say, what's that? But a lot of people also say, I had a great time. I met so many people. I met my best friend. I met my future spouse over CUCME.
That's cool. For the DoD stuff, did you guys have to set up some sort of encrypted pipe to run it through, or HTTPS? Or
we had to support that. The DoD had its own networks and its own security, but we had to run them what they had.
Okay. So you kind of like layer inside their stuff and let them harden the pipe, if you will?
That's right.
Got it. So then after that, you went on to IntelliVid, kind of staying in the same space?
Staying in the video space. Yeah, so IntelliVid, it came from intelligent video from retail, and that was out to solve a really fascinating problem of, can video help retailers run their stores? And in particular, to begin with, can it help with loss prevention? So you walk into a retail store, and in those days, you might have seen a few dozen to a few hundred cameras. Today, it can be even more. But they have all these cameras, yet they have a tremendous amount of loss of their merchandise. And it turns out that the cameras weren't very effective because when merchandise was stolen, the loss prevention officers would be fast-forwarding and rewinding video across many, many cameras to try to figure out what happened in an incident. So what IntelliVid did is it kind of sat behind those cameras, it watched every frame of video, and it figured out what were people and what were objects in these frames of video in a very generic way, no profiling, no associating names, but a person has certain attributes and objects have certain attributes. So it would identify people and objects and correlate them across time and across cameras. And that would create this big set of metadata that you could quickly search through, and you could track a person either real time or forensically through a store to see the actions, and you could go forward and backwards in time. So I knew this morning that I had a lot of razor blades, and I knew tonight that the whole razor blade supply was emptied out. Let me figure out during the day each person who walked by, and let me trace their steps. So it brought a process that was many hours down to a couple of minutes to figure out what happened.
Hey, sport. How was school today?
It was okay, Dad. How was work?
Ugh. Actually, I had a rough day. Leading an engineering team is hard. I mean, I have to ship new software, meet deadlines, and tackle new projects while keeping my team focused on the day-to-day. It's hard to keep up.
Jeepers, Dad. Why don't you call Syrinx? They're the software engineering firm run by software developers. They helped Billy's dad. He used to be stressed out like you. He was missing deadlines, his team was overworked, and a bunch of folks left the company because it was too stressful. But then he called Syrinx. And they put developers to work right away. He hit all his deadlines and freed up his team to do other work. His boss was so happy Billy's dad got some extra time off.
Time off? Wow. What did he do with that?
He spent it with Billy. Aww.
That's a swell idea, son. I'll call Syrinx today. Now, you go wash up for supper.
So if I walk by that camera, it says that guy is ID 23. And if you walk by, it's ID 42. And it notices that, you know, objects 1 through 20, the boxes of razors, all of a sudden there's 18, then 16, then 14, whenever number 23 walks by, and kind of bubbles that up.
Pretty close. Pretty close. The idea is an object is something that looks like it's part of the background, right? It's part of the image until it disappears. And when that happens, it's a permanent change to the image. A person is somebody who passes through an image, but when they pass through, when they're gone, it returns to mostly the way it was before, right? So we could say, tell me each time, essentially, somebody disturbed that image.
And were the losses more front of house or back of house, i.e. on the retail floor or employees, would you say?
The problem that we solved was mostly on the retail floor. There is a separate problem, and we were working that problem as well with the back end. But it was a fascinating problem to solve. First of all, very important. So at the time, big box retailers ran on about a 4% profit margin. And although they did not widely publish their losses were estimated to be about 1.5%.
Wow.
So about a third of potential profit was lost. Moreover, 60% of theft was employees who worked for the retailers. And the average duration of somebody who worked for the retailer and stole goods was longer than the duration of the average employee who didn't steal goods. And not that that's necessarily a good metric, right? You've been with us 5 years, you must be stealing. Okay. But the net of it was that these losses were going untraced and people were making money by stealing goods, stealing lots of them. And there were many different mechanisms to get around security.
Why would employee number 23 leave if he's making an extra 10 grand a year swiping razors?
Exactly.
Now, did anyone get real crafty and pull like an Indiana Jones? You know, like when he goes to get that idol and he replaces it with a sandbag that's the same weight. Did anyone ever try to replace with empties, or was it pretty much swipe, I notice the object is now missing?
That's a really good question. I don't remember any cases like that, but I'm sure there were. But there were some incredible cases that we saw in videos where people would go get a big container in the store and then fill up that container with objects and walk out of the store with the container.
Right?
There's another trick of the trade, which is the entrances and exits to the stores have the pedestals to catch tags that may be on. But if you line a bag with foil, the signal does not get through the foil, right? So we saw the video at these stores. You know, we helped them figure out how to customize the system. And it's incredible the different ways that people had to get items out of the stores.
What were the high value items that they saw people targeting? You mentioned razors. I'm sure that was one, because now they're pretty much locked up at every store you see. What else were people going after?
Anything that was relatively small and high value. So things like mobile phones, for example, mobile players, baby food, clothing. At a luxury retailer, it was high end pocketbooks that went for $10,000 apiece.
Wow.
Every weekend, thief would show up and take one or two of those pocketbooks.
Huh. Yeah, I imagine it's worth it for Louis Vuitton to start figuring out what's going on here. Do you have a story there from what a great team can do?
That was an amazing team. So that was a startup company. And, you know, we were always running scrappy. We were out to change the world. But we had some huge challenges, particularly some very aggressive goals set by partners of ours. At first, we looked around and we said, this is impossible to do. We said, you know what? We need to do this. We're going to do this, right? And the team sectioned off and said, I'll take this, I'll take that, and just worked together seamlessly. And on these deliveries, they were absolutely perfect. You couldn't have asked for better. And that's what our customers told us. And it's funny, that company was eventually acquired by Tyco. Tyco saw value as a next generation solution. And that team was asked to kind of deploy around the world and share what they did and how they did it with other Tyco teams so we could adopt similar practices at Tyco.
So the giant company snaps up the nimble little startup and then figures, all right, let's see if we can take some of this DNA and intersperse it throughout the enterprise.
That's right.
How did it go?
It went fantastically. I mean, we literally sent engineers around the world out to Belfast, to India, to China. And our first challenges at Tyco were very big. We had a very aggressive new product line to launch and another acquired product from Tyco that needed to be re-architected and scaled for the market. And so we had a lot of people, a lot of teams, a lot of stuff to sort through very quickly. very efficiently and kind of a new norm to set. And like I said, this team was absolutely fantastic in getting out there, sharing what they know, building bonds, and that allowed us to take on the next challenges.
Now, were there other acquisitions that they asked you to fold in or maybe turn around if things weren't working out so well?
Yes, absolutely. So Intellivid was acquired by Tyco to apply essentially analytics to their next generation security systems. And we were the second acquisition in that set. The first acquisition did not go exactly as planned, and sometimes that happens. What Tyco bought was a little bit different than what it intended to buy. And when our team was looking at that technology, we kind of came back and said, we know you want to bring this to this particular place. It's not going to get there. It's going to need a lot of work to adapt. And the customers were saying the same thing about that product, the early customers. So in addition to taking on the Intellivid integration, we were asked to take on the whole server side of this next generation product. So it was welcome to big time. A lot of things to be done quickly, and tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue are counting on you. Good to work.
Yeah, that'll put the pressure on.
Yes.
So after that, I think you did a bit of an industry switch, moving more to payments for e-commerce at Credorex.
That's right. Yeah. Credorex is a fascinating company, very groundbreaking. The problem that they solved was e-commerce merchants that wanted to sell cross-border. And that's a very tricky thing. So it used to be that for each country you wanted to sell in, you needed three partners. You needed one partner for payment processing, one partner for banking, and one partner for currency conversion, times the number of countries you wanted to sell in. Credorex said, hey, we think we have a better way of doing this. We'll do one-stop shopping. So you would go to Credorex, and Credorex had banking licenses in about 15, 20 countries. At that time, it was a payment processor, it was a bank, and it had currency conversion relationships put in place. So really one-stop shopping to the customer under the hood, doing business in all these different jurisdictions, imposed a lot of technical constraints.
I imagine accuracy was a big thing too, and you start getting into fractional cents and currency conversions and stuff like that.
My goodness, I never thought what the reaction to being a penny off would be. There are so many parties in the chain. You have the issuing bank, where the customer's credit card comes from. You have the acquiring bank, which was Credorex. You have MasterCard and Visa in the middle, and you have this whole ecosystem of banks doing business. So if a transaction goes off that goes through the system that's even a penny off, you've got all these big banks, regulators, and card schemes calling you up and saying, what happened? So you can imagine if there's a mistake that multiplies that times 100,000, right? Very high stakes game.
What was the technology stack you were working with there?
We worked on a Java stack. We had our own data centers at the time. Mm-hmm. So we provided kind of an end-to-end solution. There were pieces that were embedded in browsers. So for instance, a merchant console, if you've ever seen in the web pages where you can run your transaction up through the web page, there were front-end payment devices. And at the time, things like EMV and 3D Secure were coming through too. So additional verification mechanisms, very dynamic space. Things changed very quickly there.
What did you guys use on the back end for database?
That was Postgres, I believe.
Ah.
But it was a special redundant variant of Postgres. So we had replication across data centers.
Because you can't lose those pennies.
Not at all.
And I think after that, you were at Vaultive?
Yeah, I went on to Vaultive. Vaultive was a really interesting play around cloud security, around cybersecurity. The problem that it was trying to solve is I'm an enterprise, I'm storing my data in the cloud, but I don't really know where in the world that data ends up. But my customers care. And it's not my customers care because they have something to hide, but my customers care because they have confidential information and they have commitments to their clients. So maybe I'm a legal firm or a financial firm, and my customers really are not comfortable knowing that their data may end up in some area of the world where a local government could come in and get it. So what Vaultive did is it had an encryption gateway that kind of sat between your SaaS app on your desktop and the back-end cloud services from Microsoft or other cloud providers, and encrypted. Encrypted everything going out, decrypted everything coming back. So what you stored in the cloud was essentially a blob. Anyone could go in and take it, and they wouldn't be able to make sense of that data. And that gave our customers and consequently their customers and shareholders a reassurance that the data would be secure.
So does this act kind of like a proxy in between you and the cloud? Do you notice it from a client software perspective, or how invasive is it to kind of put it in the middle?
Customers and users don't notice it. It's a URL redirect. And yes, it's monkey in the middle.
Okay. After playing monkey in the middle, you went to a extremely famous, well-known, well-liked, I've got a bunch of their products myself, audio company, Bose. What have you been up to there?
Bose is a fantastic company, as you mentioned. It's so great because you don't have to explain to people what they do. People hear Bose and they're like, I love that company. I love the products. So our mission at Bose has been in business a little bit over 50 years, and they build the best consumer electronics devices, audio devices in the world, in my opinion. What we wanted to do at Bose is cloud connection, cloud connected experiences, and connecting to third-party services, voice personal assistants, music services, and all kinds of things that you can get these days in the cloud. So our challenge at Bose was, as it always is at Bose, is at scale, right? Building a cloud, building services for millions and millions of customers around the world.
So to be able to have your connected speaker experience and hook it up to your online content providers and that sort of stuff?
That's right. Connected speaker experiences, multi-room, multi-speaker setups, connecting headsets to speakers, but on the back end, supporting all these different experiences. So whether it be Google or Amazon's voice personal assistants, Pandora, Sirius, Deezer, Spotify music services, or other functionality that's available through the cloud.
Yeah, I would say that Bose definitely has the name, the legendary audio quality. Everyone I knew wanted a pair of 901s back in like the 80s and 90s. You know, now a lot of folks love their noise canceling headphones, the over the ears. Like, folks can't see this, but that's what Jeff is wearing right now. And, you know, kind of connecting that and frankly competing with the Sonos and other folks in the world trying to do the same thing. I would think Bose would kind of leverage their acoustic background to have a leg up. Is that the way they go at it?
Bose is awesome at acoustics. They understand every detail and nuance and put such planning and testing into the products. Bose is awesome in that it has a wide breadth of audio products as well. So there are the headphones, there are the smart speakers, there are the sound bars, but Bose also has car systems, factory installed car systems, professional systems for enterprise, for bands. And it has also announced some health products to aid in sleep and hearing. So across all these different aspects, it's able to apply this really great understanding of audio.
I'm guessing when you have millions of folks banging on this at once again, performance is a chief concern. How do you guys scale on demand to make sure that everyone's response is nice and snappy when they're interacting with these services?
Performance and reliability are top for us. So within the devices themselves, we do a lot of work and a lot of testing around making sure that we're within the device limits. When we talk about the cloud-connected services, you know, we're leveraging technologies that are out there and experienced vendors that are out there to scale, to keep reliability, to monitor, to tune the systems.
And then outside of work, you're somewhat of a tech enthusiast as well. What are you interested in these days?
I love my gadgets. So I've been playing with a lot of the latest technologies from Bose, of course, with my sound bars, my new headsets, my new wearables. Bose has Frames products out that I wear when I'm biking. They have new earbuds, wireless earbuds as well, the truly wireless in-ear products. I'm connecting those things up through the voice personal assistants through Amazon and Google. And I just bought myself a new TV to bring everything into the ecosystem as well.
Ah, nice. My latest purchase, and I'll give it the underserved, undeserved endorsement because I am not compensated for it, is the Eero, E-E-R-O. Have you heard of this thing?
I don't think so. What is it?
It's a little device, probably about 6 inches by 6 inches and about 2-3 inches tall, plugs into your existing network, and basically kind of takes over your Wi-Fi and manages it for you and supports Wi-Fi 6 and like a bunch of the new standards. So if you've upgraded your house to have a really fast connection and now your 10-100 lines are kind of the bottleneck, especially once you're routing Wi-Fi through that as well, you plop these in instead. I basically got rid of the Nighthawk routers that I had in my house and put in these Eero's, and they make a mesh network of the same SSID throughout your house. So wherever you go, you can kind of roam within your house, and it has ultra fast throughput. I'm getting like 600 plus megabits per second now on Wi-Fi.
Wow.
Which is screaming.
Wow. I could really use that here. I actually see a glitch in my Wi-Fi when the kids come home from school.
Well, maybe the reason RDP isn't working so well is because there are so many people relying on the internet now, especially during school and business hour overlap.
Yes, it's being taxed like never before.
Yep. So thank you very much, Jeff, for appearing on Underserved and helping us kick off season 4.
Thank you, Andrew. It's been great talking to you, and I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, we appreciate it too, and we'll talk to all of you soon on the next episode of Underserved.